The following program is for entertainment and basic informational purposes only. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of Cumulus Media, WPRB Radio, its management, or staff. This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we welcome you to the Money Talk program. And as usual on a Tuesday, I welcome my daughter, Donna Soa Allard. Welcome to the Get Back to Basics show, Donna.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. We are about to enter the month of October. And the month of October, if you listen to all of these, you know, commentators, is always warned as the most volatile or one of the most volatile months. And, you know, and people, and I've said it myself, I guess, in different ways, trying to say, you don't have to have a market correction this month. You don't have to have a bear market begin this month. But it is a month where some major negative events like the crash of 1987 occurred in the month of October. Actually, it's right around where we'll tell you when we hit the anniversary for that. But, you know, that was a market. That was an odd one because you had 2 days, Black Friday, Black Monday, 2 days, where the market dropped 22% in 2 days. I don't think any. That's the sort of thing that is triggered by an odd market-related event that catches everybody off guard. Sometimes it's a technical issue. Sometimes it's a mistake with computer programs. There's lots of little things that can occur to have those things happen. Of course, the things that a great many people remember now, the most recent, I guess, major event that affected people's view of the market was, of course, 2008. You know, of course, we had the fixed income markets, so the bond market and the mortgage markets having literally a meltdown at the time. The banking industry, that whole side of the financial services sector, it's like it froze up. Everybody was worried that the government, the politicians, all the people that were gathering together were doing two things. Number one, trying to blame somebody else. I get it. Politicians had created rules, changed the regulatory environment. And they had reasons for doing it. And I think that I don't think anybody was trying to hurt anyone. I've always said some of the biggest mistakes that the world of money makes as well as the world of politics makes are, for the most part, if you study it, they were probably well-intentioned on some level, but they were short-sighted. People didn't understand the unintended consequences of deregulation. When you start eliminating regulations, you have to go back and ask yourself up front, why were they put in place to begin with? But back, 2000, probably looking at the end of 07 into 2008, a lot of things were happening at the time. If you bought the S&P 500... at this time, so here we are in about to enter October of 2017.
Well, that was that the peak? Was that the market peak before the drop?
Well, it was
close to it.
Well, yeah, it was peaking up to that level, and it was the beginning of. We were already moving into sort of a quiet, lulling recession. The economy was slowing at the end of 07 and into 08, and then all the problems emerged. But
I'm sorry, it peaked on October 9th of 2007. That was the S&P 500 peak.
The peak.
So we're not quite there yet.
But we're almost, it's almost like a 10-year anniversary. Well, if you bought the S&P 500 index, just that index, or perhaps an ETF that tracks the index but reinvests dividends, mm-hmm. That would be the important factor here. You watched more than half of your money get erased as you moved into 08.
55% drop from peak to trough, it was a 55% drop.
You heard the concept of buy and hold pronounced. People said, okay, buy and hold as a concept for investors is dead on arrival. You watched fellow investors, a lot of them pull $200 billion out of the stock market, out of equities in one way, shape,
and
or form.
And it's so, like that. That's everything done based on emotion, right? You invested at the peak, you watch it drop, you pull your money out, and then what happens?
Well, you did all that, then you watch the people who had their money in double their money
you watch it
in the
10
years that follow. Just about anyway. You know, using, like I said, mentioning the idea of reinvesting dividends. Remember, the S&P 500 pays dividends close to the 2% range, a little over 2, which is right in and around what a 10-year Treasury pays right now. Anyway, that index has pushed its gains since October the 9th of 07 up nearly 100%. It went down 55, as Donna just mentioned, and then the benchmark gauge has made all of that back, plus a lot more, in the time that has followed.
You've doubled your money.
And by the way,
at this point,
it didn't have to get really psychotic to get there, posting annualized gains of just about 7% for the decade. That was the average annualized gain to double your money in the months that followed the correction. It was in the early 2000s, and again in 2008, where a lot of market pundits, the people who are the commentators, the talking heads you see on TV, they all came out and they said, that's the end of the 10% per year for the stock market concept. There was a period prior to that, you know, in the 90s, 1980s, 1990s, where if you asked somebody what their expectation was of a stock-based portfolio, you'd say, yeah, you could do on average in a broad-based portfolio, buy and hold, about a 10% average return. Senior portfolio manager for American Century Investments is a guy named Rich Weiss. And he said that stocks have done what they almost always have done and proved yet again that even with the 2008 meltdown of the market, which was a terrible experience, they have in fact returned about 7.8% a year annually. And that's pretty much intact. Now, for investors wondering whether it's time to sell right now, because here we are once again, people are over there talking about the voices of caution, and those are getting louder and louder as the market continues to move to new all-time highs. You know, you understand that it sounds like persuasive arguments against owning stocks, right?
Yeah, but I mean, there's a really big difference between a reasonable pullback and a 17-month bear market.
Yeah, yeah.
Really big difference to consider.
One of the things that is happening here that we don't typically see in the economic environment, when you look at the fundamentals are saying, you know, corporate America is continually moving to boost their profitability. So the corporate earnings have been outpacing the expectation of the analysts every single quarter going back for years now.
Earnings have outpaced and companies have a lot of cash, which puts them in a good position.
Now, we get it. We've lived through these things. I've lived through them for 35 years of market ups and downs. And we used to jokingly say when we had, you know, I went to an event. Peter, the biggest guest we ever had on the Money Talk program was a good gentleman named Peter Lynch, who was the manager of the Magellan Fund at Fidelity. But at an event that he went to, I think it was sponsored by the AARP, he had about 500 people in that room. And he said that remember when he started the talk, he said, at some point before this, my little speech is over, before I'm done here on up at the podium, I'm going to give you the secret to successful investing. Now, just wait. So he went through the whole thing. He talked about a lot of different technical things. He says, okay, now I promised you that I was going to give you the secret. I was going to give you what you needed to know to be a successful investor. Are you ready? You ready? He says,
pen and papers out.
The market goes up. And after the market goes up, the market goes down. Now, after the market's gone down for a while, the market goes up. And then again, after it's gone up for a while, the market goes down.
And everyone was riveted.
And the thing is, it was a little bit like you might imagine, what's the comedian, Steve, he plays the violin.
Steve Martin.
Steve Martin. And he'll just come out on the stage and look up and go, I remember watching him on Saturday Night Live one time. He's looking up at the upper part of the room. He's going, what the hell is that?
And he just says it over and over.
And then he turns around and then he puts his hands on his hips. He goes, what the hell is that? And, you know, and then at some point, people just start cracking up. I mean, because he just keeps doing it. Well, I imagine the same kind of effect was. But as he put it, he goes, you know something? The lesson in all of this was that when I left the building, when everybody was walking out of the
conference. They remembered one thing.
Well, the conference going out to their cars, they're saying to each other, the market goes up, and after the market goes up, the market goes down. He says, they could forget everything else I said in a 90-minute presentation, but they remembered the market goes up, and then the market goes down. And he, you know, the funny thing about it was the greatest point of truth that I've ever said to anyone. It is, in fact, as overly simplistic and seemingly silly as it sounds, it was the secret to successful investing.
And the follow-up comment should have been, and you can't time it successfully. That's what the follow-up comment should have been.
And looking now after all these years, 2008, that financial crisis was, anybody who said that it wasn't painful is lying. Or they, simply don't remember.
Well, if you simply say, you know, your return since, October 9th of 2007 through now has averaged 7.2%, you'd say, hey, that sounds great if that's all you hear. But if you actually go back and consider what it felt like to go through the drop and then on the way back up, it's very, very different. So in order to achieve that 7.2% annualized return, you had to ride that out.
So if you did, as Donna just suggested, and we're not even saying did some fancy stuff with high-tech mutual funds. Or
nope.
Do the blue chip index that matches the 500 largest companies in the U.S., that's the S&P 500, or a fund that matches that primarily as the benchmark. And if you stuck it out, you had recouped after all of your losses in 08, all of your losses were recouped by 2013 in reaping bigger gains after that.
Yep. Now you've doubled your money from your original investment.
So it worked and your average fell back to the benchmark again. It fell right back to the mean. It reverted to the mean. And you've enjoyed that average along the way. It took, I will admit, a tremendous amount of discipline to do it. And with the S&P peaking at levels that are on average 68% higher than the prior cycle's top. You made money, but you deserve what you're enjoying financially because you had to go get past that emotional drive to pull all of your money out and sit back and be completely defensive. There's a lesson in it, folks. I'm hoping that you're listening to the advice of Peter Lynch because after the market goes down, it does, in fact, go up. I'm Don Sowa with Donna Sowa Allard. This is Get Back to Basics Money Talk right here on AM 790. We'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we welcome you back to the Money Talk Get Back to Basics program with Donna Sowa Allard and myself. I'm Don Sowa. Thanks for tuning in during your drive time home. Now, we get questions that are sent to us sometimes over our website at sowafinancial.com, and you click on Money Talk on the icon, and you get on there. Not only do you have an opportunity to look at some podcasts for previous topics and discussions we've had on the show, but you also have an opportunity to give us ideas, questions that you might have or ideas for future programs that you would want us to talk about, topics to develop. And we got one, and this was interesting. Now, this was a case. Now, you may say, this person's not me. But this is a person who was in their 50s, and he was saying, well, he's heard us talk many times about preparing and how much time you have to prepare for an independent retirement and how important time is. But in his case, he is looking to retire early. He doesn't want to wait till his 60s.
People are, you know, driven to early retirement for all kinds of reasons. Sometimes it's because of a change within the company you work for. Sometimes it's health related. Sometimes it's because, you know, a loved one needs to be cared for. There are all kinds of reasons that people suddenly find themselves looking to retire before their full retirement age of Social Security or 65 for Medicare, or even 59 and a half, which is when you're allowed to take money out of your qualified retirement plans.
You know, the other thing, too, and this is sort of the tone of this particular questioner, was that he is the type of person that likes to be active, but because of the investment he has to make in his work time, the time investment, he can't do all the things he likes to do. He likes rock climbing. He likes adventure and vacations and doing all this. And granted, the one thing
you don't have enough time for your hobbies because you're working.
The one thing that's the issue. One thing that happens related to career is that as you get out of school and you start to embrace the career, you're going to make decisions about how much money you need to live on. You're going to make decisions about how much income you have to have. You're going to look at your potential for earning. And so, yes, somebody's paying you now for your time. Mm-hmm. And so you're giving up your time so that a company will provide, make their money machine available to you to do two things. Number one, to support your existing lifestyle and choices you make. And number two, as we've often talked about on this program, to build your own money machine. The money machine that you get because you have a service or a skill that somebody values, okay, they let you use their money machine, and yes, you get a paycheck from that every 2 weeks.
What a different way to look at your job, by the way. It's a company allowing you to use their money machine, so you can go be productive and use their money machine. That kind of, if that's the philosophy you take into your job, it kind of changes the way you must look at going to work, I would
think.
Well,
it does, unless you have, instead of a job, you have a career. I know this sounds like the same words. They're not the same words. People who view the time they spend at the company, at the office, or wherever it is they are.
A career is developed. A job is performed.
Yeah.
It's different.
If all of you're getting out of the job is, of course, the paycheck, then it's going to be... It's going to be hard, and you may be the one who's more inclined in your early to mid-50s to be subtly looking for ways to say, how is it possible for me to actually not go to work every day anymore, or maybe cut back dramatically on... I mean, that would have been my answer, of course. This was a question that was left in the form of a written question for us. But if I were meeting privately in my office with a person doing a consultation, and they said, these are my goals, I'm 51, I'd like to retire by 54 or 55, because I don't want to be an old man and not be able to do the things I currently, when I do have free time, these are the things I love to do. I'm a very active person. My wife and I, or my partner and I, we're very, very active people, and I want my retirement or semi-retirement to represent more time, me recapturing what I gave up in order to get a paycheck every 2 weeks. So I get it. I understand the mindset behind that.
Depending on what you like to do, you got some things you have to do while you're younger.
I mean, if I didn't have a brilliant daughter and son who could come into the business with me, I would probably be looking back and say, well, I have to work pretty much every single day and get in there and be there to do everything and make sure everything is working correctly. But I got lucky. But I also took the risk of starting my own business when I was a younger man in this profession. Because of that, you can have choices about, well, what direction will the business go? What direction will your career go? So I decided, because especially when you came into the profession and our son Daniel, who's chief operating officer for the firm, it meant I suddenly had the opportunity to capture some of my time, the time that belonged to the business that had to be there so that it would run smoothly. And now we can do the long weekends. And really, that's much for my wife or your mom, that's an important thing to have the ability to make choices, to go visit, and actually take a trip. You could get on a plane and spend 2 days someplace and then get on the plane and come back.
Well, what you have is a situation that a lot of people are looking for as they move towards retirement. And some of our clients have it as well, where instead of just retiring, they kind of transition into it by working, a shorter schedule, working 2 days or 3 days. And rather than having to actually retire early, you can have this, transition into it. But if you couldn't, and you needed that time for one reason or another, and you actually had to retire early, you'd have to look at some different options for
generating
income.
Well, these are the questions. What are the considerations first? I'm also going to ask you about what are the shortfalls you have to avoid, the problems that come up uniquely to a person.
There are a lot of problems that are coming up. Arise.
There can be penalties to doing this wrong, costs to doing it wrong. But what, in order to do it right, what are the first considerations that this young 50-year-old or 51-year-old has to look at to think whether 54 is a realistic issue?
54. All right. So the first thing that I'd be asking myself is, how much money do I need to live the life I want to live? So what is my ideal budget, right? Or what do I need for income? And the second thing is, have I saved enough money to generate this income?
So they have to sit down with that yellow pad and calculator, and I'd say do it with your partner together at the kitchen table and say, what will it cost realistically to be me?
Because you have to consider that there are costs that arise in early retirement that are not there. They'll eventually go away. But I mean, I would say the biggest thing is the fact that you have to add in the cost of health insurance, private health insurance, until you reach age 65. So you're going to be out on the open market buying health insurance. That's something that has to get added into your budget for a number of years. And what you just suggested, you know, it would be for 11 years until you qualify for Medicare. So that's a big thing to add into your budget on a monthly basis.
Yeah. Are we pretty close to going to a break, or how much time do we have? Yeah. Is this somebody waiting on the line? Okay, I'll tell you what. Why don't we go to break right now, and then we'll talk to Tyler and Warren right as we enter the second segment, the next segment. Is that good? Super. This is Don Soa with Donna Soa Allard. It's the Money Talk Get Back to Basics program. We are taking your calls at 437-5000 and 888-345-0790. That's the toll-free number, 888-345-0790, and we'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Don Soa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we welcome you back to the Money Talk program. I'm Don Soa with my daughter, Donna Soa Allard. We are certified financial planner professionals, and hey, we've been doing this show for an awfully long time. This Tuesday program is the Get Back to Basics program, which means we try to focus on things that are at the foundation of decisions you're trying to make. Maybe it's the decisions off which the other peripheral decisions will be made. It's the place to start. So let's go out to the phones and talk to Tyler at Warren. Hey, Tyler, welcome to the show.
Hey, good evening, guys. How are you?
Very, very good.
Excellent. Just a quick question for you. I feel a little funny asking because it's something I probably should know, but I find rebalancing to be really the most daunting challenge. Especially, it's hard not to be nostalgic with stocks that you have, you know, when they've done well and everything else. But I've started the process, and I just had a quick question for you. Let's say you own said equity on the ex-dividend date, and you make the decision to sell that stock, you know, 2 weeks after the ex-dividend date. Will I still receive the dividend compensation after I've sold it, but because I held it during the ex-dividend date?
Yes. The short answer is yes, you will. If you own it on the ex-dividend date, even if you've sold it, you still receive the dividend.
That's actually why the trade desk keeps track of the ex-dividend date, Tyler. It's because it's a stock exchange that you're dealing with, you know, when you do the trade. And part of their responsibility is to make for an equitable transition of ownership between the person who owns the shares, which is you, and the person who's potential. Somebody, remember, when you sell it, somebody's got to be buying it, right? So there's going to be an adjustment in the pricing on that to accommodate you receiving that dividend, put it this way, on the way out. So remember, you're getting cash, right? Somebody's buying your shares. So your cash payout, though, will reflect the dividend.
Hence my embarrassment, because if I'm going to be dabbling in this, I should know
but I don't need to be embarrassed.
Hold, so it generally... It's the first time that I've ever really encountered this issue, because I try not to do a lot of trading in that regard. But I had made some gains on some stocks, frustrated with some of the company's direction, Disney, for instance. So I said it was, you know, take your gains and cut losses. I was just curious as far as how that has been. So said equity is sold, ex-dividend paid passes with me being a holder. The dividend distribution date comes. Will that be converted directly into cash because I'm no longer a holder, or will that be fractional shares?
So it depends what the instructions are on your account. When you set up your account, you probably set it up to either automatically reinvest dividends or to put them into cash. So that's the answer. So I would check that.
But it depends on
how you set it up.
Ultimately, Tyler, if you are no longer an owner of the shares, then then you're going to receive cash in place. In other words, you're not entitled to new shares.
As the new
owner will, upon availability, become eligible to receive fractional shares. Again, as Donna says, if he codes his portfolio, his account that way. But like you said, you will not once the actual dividend is paid out to other people. their ownership interest is what determines whether they get fractional
but
shares
he means
of cash.
To him. He means to him.
Well, he will get cash.
It comes in as cash.
Because this is calculated at the time you are in the process of selling your shares.
Awesome. Thank
That's
you
good.
Guys.
So you're taking some
like
gains.
Said,
so you made some money.
I'm more of a buy and hold, and I haven't really encountered this before, and I do find the rebalancing to be the most daunting challenge. So that answers all my questions.
Well, another nice thing for you, Tyler, right now is if all of a sudden you have cash in your portfolio, you have to start thinking of it in terms of opportunity value. If you haven't already allocated it for some other project or something outside of your investments, the market may offer. I'm not looking for any major corrections in this environment, but we may be seeing some pullbacks out there. And even a stock like Apple right now at 152 in that range, it's sitting there considerably below what its high was, and it's likely going to go higher. But I'm saying that's not the only stock that's like that. There's going to be a number of...
I'm just waiting for the sale starts, Don. I bought Bank of America at $6 a share. I'm just waiting for the sale to come. So I hear you, brother.
Ty, you're the man. Take care now.
Thanks so much for your call. Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Money Talk program, Get Back to Basics. You know, it's interesting. Some people want to go through the process, like our listener, Tyler. They want to go through the process of researching, finding companies that, and by the way, the process says companies that you are interested in the company. Forget about the stock for 1 minute. Just say, it's a company that I'm familiar with, or I've done my homework on it. I like what they do. I ask certain specific questions, like, are they important in the field that they're in? Are they an important company? Do they represent innovation?
I'm trying to remember which fund manager it was we were talking to, but he made the good point of always saying, we only buy companies who do something that no one else can replicate. And whenever we buy, I wish I could remember where it was. It was a large cap growth fund that was slightly atypical. And they're saying, you know, every time we buy a company, one of the questions we ask is not just, what are their fundamentals, but does this company do something that no one else can replicate? And I think at the time they were talking about they had a large position in Amazon, and this was years ago.
Yeah.
And they said, this is something that we've looked at, and as we go out, we say, nobody can really replicate this, not at the same scale, not in the same way anytime soon.
And they proved to be right, didn't they?
And they were absolutely right, yeah.
I mean, who does what Amazon does?
But a lot of people are trying to. But
I mean, a lot of people would love for them to go away, but I mean, they're not going to.
The point is that you really get to know what you're buying and why you're buying it. Right.
Now, and that's true. And then once you've decided that this is really something I'm interested in, it's something and then ask yourself the question, should I buy this if I can get it at the right price? Well, then you're going to determine what the right price is. And there's different ways you could go about doing that. There are analysts out there. When you go online and plug in the symbol for that company, there are a number of different websites on there. They're all free. You could go in like MSN.com. And click on the money side. There's Yahoo Finance. On these websites, the full pages come up. Choices of multiple pages come up. You can click on them. And if you click on the analysts icon, they're going to come up and you're going to say, okay, there are 12 or 15 primary analysts. I mean, there may be seemingly more people following the stock, but primary analysts working for the big wirehouses that they do spend a lot of money on research. And they're going to be in there and they're going to say, okay, well, this many have a strong buy on it. This many have a buy. This many have a hold. This many have a sell. And then there may be some that have an aggressive sell. So there may be five different trading recommendations in that place. And some of them use different terms for that. But you can click on any one of them, and you can find the analyst will tell you why they consider it a strong buy. If they consider it a strong buy, that means they probably believe it is trading below what it's worth. In other words, it may even... If you say, based upon discounted cash flows and a lot of other factors right now, this stock should be worth $50 a share, yet for some reason it's trading at $39 or $40. Well, if that's the case, it's trading $20 below book value, then it's considered a value stock. Even if it's a growing company that you've been saying in any other area, it's a growth company. No, but if it's trading 20% below book value, it is a value stock. So, you know, no matter how you look at it, that may be the reason you say, yeah, I like it. I'm interested in it. I understand it, I think, what the company does, and I love it at this price. So if that's the case, there's your decision to buy. Now, you must know yourself personally and say, how much risk am I willing to take? What percentage of my portfolio should this holding be? And the rule for a great many people is that you don't often want one issue, one stock, one company, to be more than, say, 10% of your portfolio, typically. Now, again, it depends on the nature of the company. Now, Donna, when we were off there, you were saying that based upon conversations you've had with some clients, it's not unusual for somebody to ask a question like, you know, an important company, say in the utility sector, and say if it's in the commodities such as oil, gas, or any of those, who is the biggest leader in the world of oil, gas, and other alternative energy sector? And
that's, I hope I'm going to say what you want, but I'm thinking about ExxonMobil.
Well, yeah, it's Exxon. It is ExxonMobil.
I'm trying to answer your question.
No, it's ExxonMobil.
That's what comes to my mind.
You know, and it comes. You know, it falls into that. You know, that category.
Right now, I'm not investing in energy. Technically, energy is in. Isn't it technically in a bull market because it's up more than 20%? It seems weird to say that given where prices are right now. But I think, like, technically, because it's up 20% or more, it's technically considered to be in a bull market. I'm not totally sure on that. But that being said, it's been making me think, you know, as a long-term hold, is this something that I want to buy? I don't feel like, you know, personally, how much lower can prices go, right? You don't see them going lower at this point. They could. They certainly could. They have been. But, you know, as a long-term hold, it's something that, you know, could be reasonable. But if you're just looking to hop in and out for a quick profit, it's definitely not something I'd be buying.
Well, the first thing you have to look at is because the direction of the price of oil itself, and ExxonMobil is a multi-tiered company.
Yeah.
It's not just oil or natural gas. But January, the first trading day of this year, the stock was trading at $90 a share. And right now it's at $80 a share. So it has dropped during that period of time. Now, what has happened subsequently is it pays a fixed dividend. So it's paying out almost, it's just under 4% dividend right now. There are not too many companies that pay out like that. But what it does mean to you if you're a potential investor is that this may be a good time to buy, number one. You know, it's the price has dropped down. Because it does answer the other questions you were asking. Is this a critically important company? Now, yes, there's other companies that are in the field that ExxonMobil is in, and they dabble in the same areas in terms of development and research and a lot of other things. But is there anyone who does it as well as ExxonMobil does? I mean, people say, who are the biggest investors in things like electric cell technology, if you're dealing with power cells? The types of things that are used on spacecraft, the people who did NASA hire to come up with those with the chemical processes that create electricity on board a space station. You know, who are the biggest investors in areas like wind power technology or even hydroelectric? Well, GE may build a lot of the big things, but some of the biggest investors in development and in the research R&D side of it are companies like ExxonMobil. Now they do it selfishly because they say hydrocarbon business, oil and gas, may not be 100 years from now. So they're not thinking about
survival.
They're not thinking about their profits for the next 90 days. I mean, a company the size of ExxonMobil is like a company the size of GE or any of these places. They're looking down, you know, years and decades down the road in addition to just looking at what the profits are going to be in the next quarter. So I think it's important. And while you are waiting for a company like ExxonMobil to have their share price get back up to a level you're happy with, they're paying you a dividend. It's like they're paying your rent for having the decency to buy their shares. They say, we will reward you for your patience and your loyalty by paying you out a 4% dividend. And that may not sound like a lot, folks, but
it's better than a 10-year treasury.
A 10-year treasury is paying like 2.2.
It's better than a 10-year treasury.
Or any CD at the bank, anyway.
And it's higher than the average dividend on the S&P 500. So.
Folks, you're listening to the Money Talk Get Back to Basics program with Donna Sowa-Allard and myself. I'm Don Sowa. We'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we're back with the Money Talk program with Donna Allard and myself. I'm Don Sowa. Now, in the first half of the show, we introduced the question of what does an individual have to think about if they're seriously thinking of an early retirement, in this case, a person who is probably 51 looking at a possible 54 age for retirement. You mentioned at that point, the first thing is to look at your budget, figure out what does it cost to be you?
Yeah.
So do the cash flow statement.
The thing about preparing for retirement isn't to say, you know, at what age can I retire? But and I think it was George Foreman who said this. It's not what age can I retire, but at what income? And it was a really smart thing to say. It's because it doesn't matter what age you are if you don't, if you can't generate the income to support your lifestyle. So whether you're retiring at 51 or 71, you need to be able to generate the income to live the lifestyle you're determined to live. So if you're under 59 and a half and you're going to be doing this, you're going to be retiring, you need to generate enough income to pay all your bills, do the stuff you want to do, and as I mentioned, I think two segments ago, pay for your health insurance before you qualify for Medicare at age 65.
So there are going to be, as always, a whole vast number of fixed expenses that, mm-hmm. that you're going to deal with no matter what happens. And then you're going to have, now in this case here, he gave me the sense that there was a lot of discretionary expenses reflecting lifestyle choices
which is lovely,
he wants to make.
Which is lovely, but that's also very good because that means that you have flexibility. If these are discretionary lifestyle choices, it means you're in control. You can say, all right, if I want to retire now and I can't afford to pay for the entire budget of what I'm looking for, well, then I'm just going to cut back on some of those discretionary items. It's your choice. Are you going to retire and cut back a little, or are you going to work a little longer to, you know, save a little more, generate that income?
No, we were using the metaphor before of the money machine, saying that, mm-hmm. okay, you're working in a job, you have skills, somebody's willing to pay you. Using their money machine, they're giving you access to the money machine to pay you for your current lifestyle. And very importantly, and this is the big thing, build your own money machine. So at some point, in this case, the gentleman in his early 50s must think that the money machine that he has built must be large enough, at least perceptually large enough, to provide him the lifestyle that he's hoping for. And so I guess that's the first thing, is sitting down and doing a financial analysis that actually spells out for you the two things: what your cash flow requirements are going to be if you do retire, and number two, is the money machine you have large enough, strong enough, and efficient enough to provide you with that kind of a life?
And in terms of that money machine that you've put together, what is it made up of? Meaning, is it all qualified assets? Because if you
401ks,
have not,
IRAs,
right, exactly, yeah. Meaning tax-deferred or tax-preferred assets, you need to consider this, because if you do not have substantial savings or some other type of passive income on the side, you're going to have to figure out a way to dip into your retirement savings without generating that 10% early withdrawal penalty that you see on your IRAs, 401ks, et cetera. And there's really not a whole lot of ways to do that other than taking a 72T distribution. And if that what that does is the IRS has this table. There's three different methods you can use to calculate what the distribution will be. But you pick a method that either gives you an annuitized payment, which is an equal payment over the number of years, an amortized payment, which is typically a little less than the annuity payment. And then the minimum, which is going to be the least amount possible and varies year to year. But you go in and based on your needs, you calculate this. But then you have to follow the rules very specifically, because if you mess up, you have a huge penalty for breaking the 72T plan.
Now, that rule allows you to gain access to qualified money in an IRA or a 401k or 403b, that type of plan, prematurely. In other words, before you're age 59 and a half. Now, the only thing that this rule, this method, does is it helps you avoid the 10% penalty.
You
will
pay
ordinary income on it.
You still pay taxes, but it's very important to realize that you don't just get to pick how much money you take out.
They tell you exactly what the number is.
Exactly what you're going to take out based on the calculation method you use. And you can't just suddenly decide you're going to stop it or change it. You have to continue on your 72T plan for 5 years and eight to meet age 59 and a half. So if you start it at age
54,
you will have to do it until you're 59 and a half.
At least.
Even so, you can do it for more than 5 years. Likewise, if you start it when you're 57, you don't get to stop it after 2.5 years. You have to continue the 5 years. So there's a lot of considerations.
Now, all Donna's suggesting is that there are ways to get money out of your 401k or your IRA without the 10% penalty. You will pay taxes. My rule of thumb in this case, if this gentleman was, instead of writing in a letter to us, was instead sitting in my office, I would simply say, tell me how much money you have in the bank. How much money do you have in your individual or your joint non-qualified investment plan. Because my rule would be, leave all of your qualified money alone. Because remember, when you get to age 60, you could be around for a long time after that. And that's the money that was really designed to support you in retirement.
You know, and that's really the other consideration. When you have someone retiring early, is saying, you know, you're probably going to live for a really long time. So you have to make sure you aren't too frivolous now. You've got to make this money last.
So do you have some, I would hope that the fact that he came up with the question to begin with meant that he had a lot of money in personal savings. Maybe he sold a piece of property. Maybe he was a successful saver, disciplined investor in other areas in out of the individual or joint account, which he can put money into at will or take money out at will, and engage maybe in some tax strategic planning. I would say, all right, we got to get you from 54 to 60, say. So that's, we're going to draw money out of not the IRA, not the 401k plan, but your individual or your joint account for the next 6 years. Now, as a percentage of withdrawal, it may be higher than I normally would consider, but I'm willing to go that route if I say, add that money that's non-qualified to all of your qualified money and say how much you're drawing out, what percentage is that, but you're not going to touch the IRA at all, the 401k at all, and you will draw down money from your individual non-qualified account. If you can afford to do it, if there's enough money there to do it, then I'll say knock yourself out, go out and do it and have a good time. But then, of course, figure out a good, solid investment and distribution plan that will work and stick to it as best you can.
You know, I have clients who are looking at retiring early, but also are going to be receiving income from investment properties they own. So lots of times there can be a mix of ways to generate income. Maybe you have passive income from a business that you've sold that you continue to receive a payment for, or rental properties combined with your own savings.
Well,
so
the reason it could work is because the largest, hopefully, part of your plan is from those qualified assets, the IRAs, the 401ks, and you are not, if it was positioned right, you're not going to touch it until you get into what would be normal retirement age, when you may also have access to Social Security.
But I think the bottom line is you need to plan ahead if this is something you hope to do, right?
And in his case, particularly if you're listening right now, sit down with your financial advisor, mm-hmm. ask all these same questions, and give that advisor all the information they will need to help you make really good decisions, and never look back saying, oh, I wish I had known this or that and made a different decision in the past. Folks, you're listening to Get Back to Basics Money Talk on AM 790, your home of talk and business, with Donna Soa Allard. And Don Soa, thanks for tuning in. Tune in tomorrow. Steve Bovee will be here at 5 o'clock with more Money Talk. Have a good night.